Here Be Monsters is a show that invites you to explore fear and the unknown.
I saw her face change. I saw her see where I'd pulled my hair out.
Psychological warfare was always considered kind of an oddity, something done by freaks.
On the count of three, we're literally going to step out of our body. Step out.
You can find Here Be Monsters now at kcrw.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Michael Silverblatt, and welcome to Bookworm. Today, my guest is Chris Lee. She was on the show with her book of short stories, Drifting House, and now she's written her first novel, How I Became a North Korean. I think it's a book that presents a lot of political questions about the boundaries between North Korea, China, South Korea, but about boundaries in general and maps in general, first of all, because I assume that many of my listeners will not know, where do people escaping from North Korea go?
That's a great question, Michael. First, thanks for having me on your show.
It's a pleasure.
The North Koreans generally have to escape through the Chinese border because if they head south, they meet up against the DMZ, the 38th parallel to South Korea, which is the most heavily armed, the area that is like a minefield, essentially, and there's no way they can really cross there. So China's the last and only other border open to them outside of, I think, a very narrow strip of Russia.
In China, they are treated not just as second-class citizens. They're treated, if I take your book to be representative, they're treated like animals.
It depends, again, on who they meet, as we know all individuals have different responses. But officially, because the government doesn't recognize them, the Chinese government doesn't recognize them as refugees, as a result, they have no legal protection whatsoever. And if they're sent back, it's not as if they just serve basic jail time in North Korea. So as a result, all sorts of opportunists from the various races, I suppose you can say, whether they're Korean or Chinese Korean or their own North Koreans who now cross over as spies and try to track people down, they're prey to everybody.
When you say they're not recognized as refugees, does that mean essentially they have no status whatsoever?
Yes, technically, they don't exist.
Oh, my. We are, of course, in America, dealing with questions of borders and the threat to make a border into a nightmare of impenetrability. You have been, in your own life, involved in working with North Korean refugees. What does that mean?
Well, I became friends with refugees that had come down to South Korea, as well as the activists who were my friends as well. So I became interested in them because I was interested in them as people. And when you care about the losses and the suffering that they have endured, you become involved in whatever way you can to help, which I think is just a normal human reaction. The injustices that they face are something that you can't just stand by and watch. But as I was writing the book, I was not only interested in North Koreans. I mean, the book is about their world and what they face. But I was drawn to that story because of the borders and the boundaries that are both literal and metaphorical throughout the world. I thought a lot about what happens between Mexico and the United States, the boundaries that we see in the borders, the struggle that is happening throughout Europe and really causing us to question, what is Europe? What kind of a continent can we become is the question, I think, that is resonating there today. And I also thought about the way that we build boundaries between each other, because once you decide how a person is treated or who they are based on nationality, which I think is very clear today in America with the dialogue that Donald Trump is bringing to the forefront that we were comfortably protected from in a way before, that we are always faced with some kind of boundary, and whether we choose to create those impenetrable borders or we choose to understand and cross those borders in a way is both a national and a political issue, but it's also a personal issue. As a reader, you choose to cross a boundary because you choose to imagine what other people are like. And what I'm frightened by, the reality that we see in so many countries today, is that the leap of imagining what it's like to be another person and humanizing them as a result is becoming less of a priority.
Now, in this book, How I Became a North Korean, by my guest Chris Lee, one of the three speakers, will you teach me how to say her name?
Changmi.
Changmi?
Yes.
She is leaving home. She's going to be, in her case, crossing a river. And for her, the boundary is a physical boundary. Let's hear how she talks about it. This is Chris Lee reading from the third chapter of her book, How I Became a North Korean.
In late February or early March, I walked across the frozen Tumen River toward a man from China, ready to give my unborn child a different life. Of course, my crossing had started much earlier, maybe with the great hunger or even before I was born. The China beyond the river that day was as dried up and brown as my country. I walked with the eyes of men and women following me from both sides of the shore. I remember being hopeful, though the river banks were still hoary with the remaining snow. A border patrol who the man from China had bribed followed me across. There were broad, dark patches where the ice looked as thin as glass, but I was from a border town. I had smuggled goods in and out since I was 14 and knew how to read the river. I looped around where the ice became dangerously clear until I was standing in the center of the frozen river and facing the man from China, a Joseonjok, so he spoke our language. He had an eager smile and a small head. He was small everywhere, it seemed, and he limped slowly forward as if needing my permission to come closer. With every step, his left leg swung out rigidly in a semicircle until we faced each other. He was nervous. His right foot kept making circles on the ice behind him like a ballerina. "This man named Hongshik said, 'You really do believe me now, don't you? I'm a person who can make these kinds of things happen. I know everyone, and everyone knows me. Money? Who needs money? You need connections.' He tore skin from his lower lip with his teeth. He wanted my approval. The way he repeated himself made that clear. But we didn't have much time, so I interrupted him. 'I learn fast,' I said. 'I'll learn anything you want.' I shut my eyes tight so I wouldn't have to look at him. When I opened them, he was still shyly taking me in. The shy ones were the worst, hard to read. 'Why do you want to leave?' he asked, as if half my country, the country of his ancestors, didn't dream of living differently. I was so nervous that my fingers dug arcs into my palms. 'There are no good men in my country,' I said. He brightened as I'd intended. 'I'm a good man, I promise.' While the border guard smoked an imported cigarette from the many cases I'd given him to keep him happy, the Joseon man and I hurried through the 10 minutes of time we had to talk, the courting time that he had bought for us. Money was a symbol, a disease that infected our country. It was all the money I'd earned after quitting school during the Great Hunger, my life savings, you could call it. I was 8 when the famine changed everything. After the government rations stopped and the crops were flooded and destroyed year after year, my umma made several trips into China's border towns to find work and food to feed us. Our government had disappeared and everyone who had followed the rules, including my appa, died. I didn't follow rules. I stole and bartered and learned quickly, and I survived. But when the government devalued our money and made our savings worthless, all my work became nothing at all. There was no present, and the future looked even worse. Then my monthly bleeding stopped, and I realized I was pregnant.
Chris Lee, reading from How I Became a North Korean. Now, you've heard one of the three speakers in the book, and as we come to know her more and more, she is the one who's capable of anything. She does what she has to. That is to say, she's a very dangerous woman to fall in love with, and most of the men in the book fall in love with her. Why?
She's the kind of character I think I'm drawn to, and the kind of woman, if I were a man, or maybe even as a woman, I think I fall in love with her. I'm attracted to survivors, and for me, she was the quintessential survivor, one who would use all her resources, whether it was her strength, her intellect, her judgments, and her body, whatever it took to get out. And those kind of characters, though they might not seem savory at first, if you look at what they do objectively, you might not like them. But at the same time, you admire them because you know somehow they're going to make it. And I'm also attracted to her fear of life, her vulnerability, her fear of love. All those things, I think, attract me. The contradictions in Changmi attract me very much.
The other two characters, the two men, are not good at letting go. One of them has come from an elite Korean family. It is, I would say, a Chris Lee tactic to present us with his parents at the party at which his father will be assassinated. And he, a brilliant young man, but without any abilities to survive. He's never had to have them. He's had everything. He's been wealthy. What appeals to you about him?
He was the poetic sensibility of the book. One of the challenges of writing this novel for me was the first-person point of view. And this novel went through many different versions. I've written in probably nearly every single point of view that exists in the English language, at least in that is commonly used. And until I found the voices that felt right for the novel. But he was the one who was allowed to speak in a language that was richer, a little more playful, more meditative. And he was inspired by a friend who did have that kind of pensive character, nostalgia. And I am guilty as anyone else of both looking forward all the time and looking back. How often do we live in the very moment, that present tense?
When I say that there's a Chris Lee technique, I consider it the administration of short, sharp shocks. This party at which the father's heart is penetrated by a bullet and his whole shirt turns red, it's maybe 4 pages long. Your vision of life is of things that happen beyond one's ability to assimilate them. Let's play with the third character. He has a crush on his chemistry lab schoolmate. He thinks he's gotten a love letter, but instead it's a trap. This boy and others in his gang are there to humiliate and beat him up. Before we know it, he's not going to go back to school. He's going to run to China, where his mother, who's left his father, is there as a missionary. Ha! Now he's in China, escaping the blackmail of being named as homosexual and not wanting to go back to the high school. But what does he find? The deacon from his mother's church is hiding in the closet. He can't stay there either. Before we know it, he's living in a cave. Now, is this life, or is this the writer's sensibility?
Writing each book that I have, and I'm writing my third book right now as well, I see again and again my own vision of the world, which is one that is often dramatic, it is violent, it is hopefully, I think, more and more also about love. At a bookstore in Brooklyn, a question had come up, and I said, if there is a trinity, for me, the trinity is somehow love, sex, and violence. There is something about tenderness and connection, and then the disruption of connection, which is violence, that I return to again and again. And when I'm struggling with it page by page, I don't see and you can't calculate a page. You're following your characters. But only afterwards I realize these characters, of course, share so much with both what I know, but also who I am, which is both terrifying as well as a relief in some ways to see both yourself and yourself released in a world, and to understand that your imagination is a particular one that you have very little control over in a way. When we meet someone and we think we know who they are, I always assume I'm wrong, because I know inside that person there are multiple worlds, and each time you encounter that person in a different context or under different challenges, they become a very different person. So I'm always interested in seeing people with their family or with their colleagues or alone. If we could spy on people, they would be very different. And so I think the way I write my characters is that I'm hungry to know a person wholly, and yet in life, sometimes that's nearly, well, in life I would say it's impossible. And in fiction, as a writer, I'm allowed, the fiction gives me the gift, it grants me the gift of attempting to fully understand this character in all their infinite mysteries. And that's how each character seems, I guess, maybe surprising or shocking in the turns that they're faced with. But I think it also ends up revealing something else about that character, who's really a human being for me.
I'm Michael Silverblatt, and you're listening to Bookworm from the studios of KCRW. I'm talking with Chris Lee about her book, How I Became a North Korean. We'll continue after this short break.
This podcast is produced by nonprofit radio station KCRW. Support the podcasts you enjoy by donating at kcrw.com/join.
I'm Michael Silverblatt. This is Bookworm, and I'm talking with Chris Lee about her latest book, How I Became a North Korean, the story of three young people becoming virtually family in the shadow of hard desperation. By the end of the book, there's a extraordinary identification. The woman we heard, who by now has lost her child, her baby, speaks about going back to see the young boy who was a member of the elite family. She is about, on the final page of this book, to give this nostalgic, past-oriented character his dream. It's a much more generous impulse than we've seen in her, and yet there seems to be a moment of faith and trust that she is discovering on that final page.
I consider it like the half-open door that I think Charles Baxter has spoken of before, or that the short story Helping by Robert Stone, where at the end of the story, the protagonist has his hand raised at his wife outside, and he's had another kind of drunken collapse. And whether that's a gesture for help, or it's a gesture of conciliation, or it's a wave, it's something that invites hope and promise. And so even though I wrote the novel, I'm not quite sure what happens the page after my novel mm-hmm. ends. But the possibility of change is in all my characters, because I think that change is possible in all of us. And especially a character like Changmi, anything can happen with her, I believe.
Now, you were educated in America. You then lived in England?
And studied there, yes.
Yes. And you've made the decision that quite a few people of your generation have made to return and live in the country where your parents were born. And you're teaching where now?
I'm teaching at Underwood International College at Yonsei University. So it's a English-speaking liberal arts college within a large Korean university.
In Seoul?
Yes.
You write in English. Do the books exist in Korea, your books?
At this point, it will depend on what my agent and the publishers agree to, because that's something we're working on in the fall, yes.
Is it something you hope for?
I hope for, but I'm not one of those people who chase these kinds of things, because I trust that when the book is right, for every market is so specific, and the South Korean world, for example, may not be so interested in North Korea for a lot of reasons. I mean, North Koreans feel very neglected there in some ways, and they feel like their stories are not respected in the ways that they wish, though that's changing with the younger people right now in college. There's all sorts of historical reasons for that. But I've never written for an audience, per se. I write for myself.
There are three major speakers in the book, and the title is How I Became a North Korean. Who is that I, the I of the title?
The I for me is both all three characters, but also the reader in some ways. I'm interested in this sense of identity. You read and it's a transformative process. You become the characters you read. And identity itself is something that is both ours, but then is imposed on us by nationality and by this thing called a passport and by these borders. So reading is that way of transgressing borders for me.
So I took it, How I Became a North Korean, that a North Korean is a metaphysical state that only exists outside Korea. You become a North Korean by leaving. By leaving, you define yourself by where you have been. And where you have been means that you take on a history of departure, of suffering, of loss, that becomes your condition in the world. It is how you become a North Korean, in the same way that people from North America, from the USA, become Americans when they travel. We may not think of ourselves as doing anything odd within our borders, but once we cross the borders, we become representative of something we might never be proud of, yes?
Yes, so definitely. They, I think, the North Koreans, as well as myself as an American, I mean, there's no accident that I write this kind of book, and I'm always returning to themes of identity and boundaries and borders, because I've crossed several borders myself, and it seems to be a life like a drifting house, always in some form of transition. And I certainly felt when I left America, I started to see myself as American and started to see what that might mean. Whereas when I grew up as a kid in America and as a teenager, I never asked myself that question. What does an American look like? What is American about me? Whereas I find myself asking, you know, I might do something and I think, oh, that is very American of me, which, you know, might be a generalization, but at the same time, it doesn't fit the local culture, the Korean culture I'm in now. So I understand myself better by leaving.
Well, I found that this was really a book of leaving definition behind, that all of these characters form only really in relation to one another. Their emotional bondings and connections will give them whatever reality they have, and those bonds are themselves very frail. That the book is really examining how I became a North Korean. In other words, how I lost my home.
In some ways, it might also have something to do with getting older. I think I was looking for answers, in a way, and seeking an understanding of a history and what happened to a country, what happened to a family, what happened to, you know, the people that survived the war and then the generation after them in Drifting House. Whereas when I was writing How I Became a North Korean, I started to realize that growing older or understanding more is learning that you can't understand and that there are no clear answers and that people are unknowable. And to accept that mystery and to embrace that mystery as central to the novel instead of seeking certainty because it doesn't exist.
That's beautifully said. I've been talking with Chris Lee, author of How I Became a North Korean, published by Viking. Thank you, Chris, for joining me.
Thank you so much for having me here.
You can comment on today's show at kcrw.com/bookworm. Download the podcast from kcrw.com or from iTunes. You can also listen on demand with KCRW's smartphone apps. My co-producer is Connie Alvarez. Alan Howard is acting as producer today. The technical director is Mario Diaz. Special thanks to David Sobel, my assistant. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm.
I am a bookworm, he is a bookworm, she is a bookworm, we are all bookworms. I am a bookworm, we are all bookworms.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. You can access archives of all Bookworm programs and podcasts, the most recent ones, at kcrw.com/bookworm. The Bookworm themes were composed and performed by Ron and Russell Mayle of Sparks.
I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm when poet Adam Fitzgerald is our guest.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air, new music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FD Weekend wherever you listen.